Get up and get yourself comfortable at council table. Second case on the docket, is Crowe versus Penrose Hospital. Council present in that case?
Yes, Council for Penrose is here.
Council, okay. Okay, and the third case is Eddins, D. Eddins versus the Colorado Department of Transportation. Are council here in that case? That's a 2 o'clock case, they might well not be. Okay, let me make a short record before we start argument. These cases are all set for 15 minutes per side. There is a timing system that reflects itself to us as how much time is left, and also on the lectern, there's a countdown digital clock that will tell you how much time you have left, and there's a lighting system that does the same thing. If the appellant wishes to reserve time for rebuttal, I'd be happy to help you with that. If you tell me how much time you want to reserve, I'll give you a high sign, and you may and stop at that point, or you'll know how much time you have left. But the timer will tell you that without my assistance. You may use the time any way you please. It's yours. We have read the briefs. We have read some of the authorities cited in the briefs. We believe we understand the facts and the general nature of the legal arguments. We would suggest that you go directly to the legal arguments rather than dwell any great amount of time on the facts. The lectern is adjustable for your comfort. There is a toggle switch on your right, two toggle switches, in fact, one to raise it and lower it. So if you find it uncomfortable, please adjust it. If anyone in the room has a cell phone, a BlackBerry, an iPhone, or any other similar device that might unexpectedly make noise, please turn it off, or at a minimum, put it on silent. And if it summons you, please do not respond to it until after you've left the room, so as not to disturb the court and counsel in what is formally called an argument, but I think is more in the nature of a conversation. So if there are no questions about how we're going to proceed, we are ready to hear Reed versus AV Decking.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Steve Ray. I'm from Fort Collins. I represent Justin Reed in a personal injury case plaintiff up in Eagle County. We tried it about a year and a half ago. We brought three issues, as the court knows. The one is that the close of evidence, a directed verdict was issued by the trial judge against future reduced earning capacity and future wage costs. The second issue had to do with an agreement, a construction case, and I know the courts have read the briefs, but the question is whether or not the apportionment of fault at trial by the jury, 40% to the defendant, A.B. Decking, 40% to this young man's employer, and 20% to the general contractor, whether that can stand in light of this indemnification agreement that was signed by LPR and A.B. Decking, LPR being the employer. And the third issue is, at the close of evidence, the trial court decided to apply premises liability law. We went through the trial not knowing whether it was going to be a negligence case or a premises liability. And at the end, the court ruled that it was a premises liability case. We challenged that, and of course, our brief covers that, but I'd like to spend a little time with that as well.
Why is that important? What difference does it make whether it's a premises liability case if, in fact, the jury found negligence and awarded damages?
It's the comparison of fault, Your Honor, that matters. If they hadn't brought in as designated non-parties to compare the fault, then it wouldn't have mattered, probably. But there's a difference between, and I'd like to inject that there could be a situation where it's completely moot, but I'd like to address the court's question. There's a difference between negligence and premises liability. And in premises liability, the focus is on property, a condition on property or an activity on property. And in negligence, it hones in directly on a person's activities. And there's an interloping segment there in our instructions to the jury touched on that. They wanted to know if A.B. Decking exercised reasonable care for a dangerous condition on the property. Well, the dangerous condition was A.B. Decking's employee. And when the dangerous condition is an individual, I believe that's confusing to a jury. Jurors know, as lay people, the fundamental principles of negligence. It's a term that's used often by people, as lay people.
In this case, though, wasn't there also a danger on the premises due to the close quarters of the construction and the way that the employees were set up as far as welding underneath this area where they were installing the decking?
That did create a danger. It did. I concede that. It did. But the other thing that I raised on appeal for this premises liability is because the act was meant to protect landowners. And in its inception, it was meant to protect people that are really landowners, people that have private property and were being sued by individuals that would do some activity on their property. And
they're really landowners, but how do you distinguish the Pearson case, which seems to talk about the statute being available to authorized agents or parties in possession of the property and also to parties who are legally responsible for the property or the activities on it? It seems to go beyond what you just said.
The Pearson expanded the concept that I just explained, and it does do that. It struggled with what Pearson was. Pearson had an agreement. You know, the Neals owned the property. The county leased the property. It was a gravel mine. And the county leased the property, but they had a crushing agreement with Pearson. I'm sorry, with Black Canyon. I got the name mixed up. Pearson's the individual that drove off of the road 17 feet and landed at the bottom of his herd. So, but they struggled with how to do that. And what they finally came up with, as I read it, was control. They said you can still be a landowner if you have the sufficient control. And they found that this independent contractor did. And I think that's significant, that each case stands on its own. It was an independent contractor, so found, and they had sufficient control, and that was the end of it. And I believe that if that case were applied to this case, we didn't have an independent contractor, far from it. And there wasn't sufficient control. You know, from my brief, that this A.B. Decking, the defendant, is three or four rungs down as a subcontractor. It's a very small number of employees on a huge construction project. My point that I would ask the court to consider, the law was never intended to reach that far. For the subcontractor of a subcontractor of a subcontractor, a very small entity unsupervised on the side. That's not, if we go back to the origin of Premises Liability Act, that is not the level of people that we're looking at. They still have all the negligence laws are available to that individual, that company. All the defenses are still available. It doesn't mean strict liability, it just means what law is going to apply. But it's so far removed from the original concept that.
Are you saying there's no apportionment under premises liability, but is that why there is apportionment under premises liability, but not under negligence?
Well, I believe that if we didn't have the indemnification agreement here, there could still be apportionment. I believe that would be appropriate under premises liability. But the
point is the premises liability didn't really harm your case at all.
I don't know that it did or did not, sir. I don't know, honestly, whether it did or did not. I think I would be speculating if I said that it did. I don't know. I believe that it did. And the other reason that I brought it up for this court is that I will say that there's a lack of predictability to the bar, defense and plaintiff, about what law applies between negligence and premises liability. After the Pearson case, there was a Henderson case that seemed to expand even further what the name of a landowner is. I supplied to the courts, though, recently the Burback case, and it's in our updated case law, where they didn't call someone a landowner. But that's pretty much the extent of the law we have. And my invitation is the court to simply think about this as to whether or not this is as far, if the court wants to go and our law wants to go that far. We don't have a Supreme Court decision on it except for Pearson versus Black Canyon. And perhaps it's time to help the bar understand where this is meant to go. The definition of premises liability, the first section of it, would seem to include everything, any activity. And when Henderson was ruled on, That was Henderson versus Master Cleaners, and it was a janitorial service. Someone fell down some stairs. And they found that there was not the control that Pearson versus Black Canyon talks about. There was not the control. The reason that they brought in premises liability because of the it was an activity. This individual was responsible for doing the thing. They failed to go clean and mop up spill timely. So they said, well, that's an activity. But that's confusing to the bar. It's confusing to me because that means almost everything is results from some activity. Medical malpractice results from some activity. Is it meant for premises liability law to apply to there? And they others smarter than me can think of other examples. But it's a very interesting question, this premises liability, but that's how I feel about it and why I brought it to the court's attention. The other issue is that I'd like to talk about for a little bit, and actually in terms of importance, if it would help the court, I think that the directed verdict for wage loss is probably our most important issue. I think that the next one is this indemnification, because that took away from the plaintiff of $188,000 verdict, that took away a substantial amount of money, down to $75,000. And then the premises liability. But the directed verdict came at the close of the evidence, both sides' evidence, the defense evidence as well as ours. And once a directed verdict is raised, the law is very clear to all of us, and that is the first thing, this is the Martinez versus Chaplin case. And Martinez says very clearly, what we want to look for is an absence of evidence, if there's any evidence, reasonably. They wanted to look for an absence of evidence on the issue of injury and the work-related nature of it. The court is supposed to look at all the evidence and is supposed to take it in a light most favorable to Mr. Reed and to me at that time. They're supposed to indulge itself in all reasonable inferences that can legitimately be drawn from that evidence. It goes far beyond the evidence that's presented. Well, I know the court has read the brief. I prepared. I'm not going to go through the details of it, but I prepared two pages. One, and this is just out of my brief, about the injuries that Mr. Reed had that were testified to, not just by him, but by many, many witnesses. Two pages of injuries, and they're serious injuries. And I also prepared a list from my brief of those things that are work-related. And I will spend a little time with those facts, why this injury brings in work-relatedness.
You had evidence that, as I recall, from the briefs, that he couldn't continue to do the work he had been doing before, which was hanging steel, and that the work he was given was had a substantially lower hourly rate than the work he had hanging steel. But I don't see anything in the briefs that indicates to me that there was any economist that testified as to what the impact of this might be and over his lifetime in terms of lost earnings, reduce the present value, to give the jury a number they could work with or they could, you know, begin with, other than just trying to figure out his life expectancy, all the rest of it to determine his work expectancy, what his future income was going to be. Did you leave the jury in a position of having to speculate?
No, Your Honor, we did not. The quick answer that comes to me, or one of the answers, is that the case law doesn't really require that. It's the fact of injury, the fact of damages has to be certain. The amount of damages does not. We put on evidence of a potential, this young man, to be an iron worker, earning $18.50 an hour, potentially $27 an hour, and he was well-liked in his business, and he had a great future there. We put on evidence that he couldn't do that anymore. There are cases that I've cited where when people get in that situation, where they can't do what they did before, that's enough for an instruction on reduced earning capacity.
You required to show permanent injury, and did you do so in the record?
We did, Your Honor. We did show, I don't believe you're required to show that. It certainly helps if you can, because if you can, again, the case laws that I've cited in my brief say that once you get to that point, that itself gets you to an inference of the effect on a person's ability to work. So we did establish permanency, and so I guess we didn't matter where we had to or not. The Judge Centeno is the one that testified about that. He went to great length. It's in my list of the different things that were wrong, starting with the neck and the injuries to the transverse ligaments, very specific, and the facet joints, and talked about their permanence. And he said these things don't heal, and they're in fact permanent. The most important witness, or one of the most important, was Will Farrell. After this young man, he was 21 when he was hurt, when he went back to his home in Thermopolis, and he did, goodness, the time goes fast. he did begin to try to do different jobs. And we have someone that testified for whom he worked, Will Farrell. And Mr. Farrell was real clear. He wouldn't know. And a question was asked about an expert. No, we didn't have an economist. What we had was someone come directly that had direct information of Mr. Reed's ability to work. He said this man could not work, and he worked for him in 2007, 2008. This man, I can't believe that he could work a 9-to-5, 40-hour-a-week job. He said most employers just wouldn't put up with that. Productivity is what employers want, and this gentleman can't do it. It was because of his condition, because of his pain. And I invite the court to review that again without me belaboring the point. But Will Farrell is a very, very powerful witness. Now, would he have understood the concepts of functional capacity or vocational impairment? No. He would have hesitated if we asked him those questions. But he could sure get to the point better than any expert in the world about this man's inability to work. The jury's able to compare that to what we gave evidence about before, what he was like before. He was like a monkey. He would go high up on these this structural steel and had no hesitation. The witness said that he had without any physical limitations. I'd like to touch now, in the time remaining before I sit down, about this indemnification agreement. The indemnification agreement is upheld by the courts. There's not a case that's cited. Indemnification agreement. AV Decking is a sub of Mr. Reed's employer, LPR. LPR has an agreement with them, says, look, if you're going to do the work, you're going to get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. But if there's ever a loss to us or to our employees, you're going to hold us and our employee harmless. It doesn't matter if we are negligent or not, us and the contractor. You'll still do it 100%. Now, there's nothing wrong with that contract. There's no case cited that says there's anything wrong with that contract. There was cases, Lafarge case that I cited says that it's okay, and so did the public service case say that's okay. Even though the employer in this case, the LPR, was negligent, they still have a good contract.
Do you have any cases that apply an indemnification clause in the employee subcontractor sort of linear arrangement as opposed to a third party who comes in and tries to sue?
I don't, Your Honor. But what I'd like to say about that is I'd ask the court to read each indemnification agreement. Each case has a different indemnification agreement. In the mid-century case, which is cited, and I expect to be talked about by defense, they're specifically talked about third-party lawsuits. Ours doesn't. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that it requires a third-party lawsuit. It just simply says that they'll indemnify the LPR and the employee. Down at the bottom, it's so very, very clear. It says, and that's true notwithstanding any workers' compensation law and notwithstanding any other common law or statute, which would include the designated non-party. That's why we filed our motion for summary judgment at the trial court, and we weren't successful. The trial court finally, in the end, said, well, I don't think it's time, and then we renewed it after the trial and before application of the partitioned out fault, and I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Berkeley Mann. I'm here on behalf of AV Decking. I'd like to take a very brief couple of minutes apiece on the second two arguments because I think they warrant less attention than, frankly, the first, and I think they can be addressed in less time. So if I may, I'd like to start with the indemnity question. There is no dispute that there was an indemnity contract. There is no dispute that that contract is binding on the parties to this case, that Mr. Reed, under proper circumstances, gets the benefit of that indemnity. Now, the question is whether those circumstances actually occurred in this case. And I would like to argue and strongly suggest that the operative language, the most important language on which everything turns for this agreement is the, I won't give you the entire quote, but the opening language of the paragraph calls for AV Decking to defend and hold harmless from loss. That is classic indemnity language for purposes of a third party claim. And until or unless there is different language, and there just isn't different language, to defend and indemnify, excuse me, to defend and exact language is indemnify and hold harmless from loss, is a situation or calls upon a situation where there is a claim made that's essentially external to the indemnitor and indemnity. And when the indemnity is the subject of that claim, then the indemnitor must stand for the defense, the hold harmless, and the indemnity. There is, in this case, only a claim by Mr. Reed against the indemnitor. And while Mid-Century Insurance is, frankly, it's a mirror image of this situation, that court held, and I think held clearly, that where the claim is only on the basis of a transaction or a problem between the indemnitor and indemnity, and in fact there's defend and hold harmless language, the indemnification just doesn't apply. And that's what we have here, a situation.
Mr. Reed is not a third party?
Your Honor, he's actually a first party to the indemnity. He is, I've got to define the term, and I'm not trying to be cute in saying so. He is a first party to the indemnity because he's actually an employee of LPR Construction, and the language itself says that it's for the benefit of LPR and its employees. So I think he's a first party. There was language in the brief to the effect that he's a third party, but I don't think that's careful usage, candidly. I just think he's an indemnity. And he's not a third party in any sense to the indemnification agreement. So first question is, does the indemnification apply by its terms? I argue no, because we were never called upon, nor was there a circumstance that would call upon us to defend and hold harmless from loss. There was no claim asserted against Mr. Reed. The only claim was asserted by Mr. Reed. So under Mid-Century, it doesn't apply. Also, since the language doesn't apply, it doesn't abrogate the provisions of 1321.111.5. It certainly doesn't do so explicitly, and because the circumstance of the indemnity is what it is, it simply doesn't. Let me speak at this point to the premises liability question. Unlike counsel, do not find this a difficult proposition, because the explicit language of the statute says that it applies. We have a definition of what a landowner is, and as confusing as it is to call an apple an orange, nonetheless, the legislature is allowed to do it, and they've got a very inclusive definition. And their definition, quite frankly, is persons who are responsible for the conduct of activities on land. That's one of several alternative definitions. But AV Decking clearly was on the land for the purpose of conducting a construction activity. Construction activity couldn't be more wedded to property. We know that from Pearson, and we know it from Henderson, that construction activity, even maintenance activity under Henderson, is directed to the land. It's all about the land, and for that reason the statute applies. We also know from the Thornbury case that the statute under its present configuration for purposes of this case says that negligence claims are abolished by this statute, so that if this statute fits, then negligence should not go to the jury. And there's a point, and you perhaps saw this in the record, there were several points at which I urged plaintiff and the court to make the determination, make the election. And since no election nor determination was made as to which would go to the jury, I moved for directed verdict. And I believe the court correctly determined that there was a clear nexus of this activity to the land, and that this was an activity for which we had responsibility.
Is there any practical difference between pursuing a negligence claim and pursuing a claim under the premises liability? I understand that the statute makes them exclusive, but as far as the actual end result in the case, is there a substantial difference between the two?
Focusing very specifically on your question as you asked it, no, not for this case. Because the practical difference, if you will, the cerebral difference, the academic differences are somewhat abrogated when a party such as AV Decking admits fault. And then given that the current iterations of the premises liability statute does account for the application of 111.5, 1321, 111.5 for apportionment, there, as a practical matter, isn't any difference. The only difference, no, I was going to say something and it wouldn't be true. No, I don't think there is a difference, practically speaking. This was a case on damages, mitigation, and apportioned responsibility, or apportioned fault, as it was expressed in the jury instructions. And practically speaking, there is no difference. So, I have argued in the brief that argued in the brief specifically, if there was error, it was harmless error for that very reason. I would perhaps go one step further and say, if there was error, it was invited error. This was a pled cause of action. This was asserted by the plaintiff as being properly before the court. Plaintiff didn't even want to make an election. Plaintiff took the position both claims should have gone to the jury. And that was the argument that we were having, was that both claims should go to the jury. The court followed Thornbury, and I believe followed the statute, and made the decision, I believe it made appropriately. With reference to future loss of income.
Let me ask you some questions about that.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with Mr. Ray that there was evidence in the record of permanent injury?
Permanent injury as distinct from two other concepts. But yes, I do believe there were, and let me speak to those concepts because I think that there are critical distinctions in the case law and in this case. There was evidence of permanent injury, no question about it. The plaintiff was properly compensated for permanent injury by the jury. This is a series of steps. Permanent injury may or may not lead to a determination, depending on the proof, of permanent impairment. He was also given a award for permanent impairment, for physical impairment. Now, the third step on the way is critical, and it's the step that the evidence didn't get to. The third step is what is, synonymously called future loss of wages, vocational impairment. There may be some other phrases that are appropriate, but it's that question that's the problem. And just by way of example, if a lawyer loses mobility, a lawyer is probably not, at least in generic terms, vocationally impaired, probably not subject to or able to make a claim of future losses, because lawyers probably are not, assuming they have adaptive technology and traditional legal environment, they can move around as necessary in a wheelchair, on crutches, on other things, and it won't impair their performance as lawyers. Here what you have is one particular assertion in the record, but I think it bears very close scrutiny, that Mr. Reed was unable to work at heights. If you take particular close look, as I'm sure you will, at pages 499 and through 501 of the transcript, this is where Dr. Centeno is asked, actually by me, not by the plaintiff, isn't it true you've only ever issued one restriction? And he said, yes, it was a restriction for heights. And then that's all that essentially is said. He does not say this is a future restriction. He does not say this is a permanent restriction. He doesn't even give us a duration for the information he's put into the record. It's abandoned there. It's never picked up by the plaintiff. And in fact, I believe it's at page 501, Dr. Centeno says he's never even communicated this restriction to Mr. Reed. It never came up in their treatment. And he further explained, or in response to questions, that he didn't even know that Mr. Reed had been working at heights for portions of 2 years before
he had been working at Heights, but a different type of work, isn't that correct?
Yes, that's true. It depends on how functionally you look at the situation. And functionally, his iron work put him higher, but Dr. Centeno said it didn't make a bit of difference to him. Height was height for purposes of the discussion he and I had in those few pages. Also, iron work is heavy work. It's, bluntly put, it's just you haul a lot of metal. But Mr. Farrell, in his testimony, allowed us how the work that he was having Mr. Reed do put him on rooftops hauling 75-pound shingle bundles. So functionally, it becomes a question of should somebody, would somebody, did somebody make a distinction between what he clearly did, and for which there was no contest that he did it, and the things that he purportedly couldn't do. And the fact is, there was no one called to address any vocational aspect of the case. And even if it had not been a matter, as Your Honor indicated, of doing the math for the jury, it would have been a matter of helping them come to grips with the substance of occupations, when, in point of fact, heavy work at Heights was being done by Mr. Reed long before he ever got to Dr. Centeno. Dr. Centeno left the record entirely unclear as to whether this height restriction was present, past, or some duration into the future, or permanent. Never spoke to any of that. So that's a large problem in the record for the plaintiff, that he didn't present clear evidence that a jury could then comprehend other than by speculation. I'm the first to acknowledge and would readily acknowledge that, sure, a jury can speculate its way to a future wage loss. It's just that the law doesn't permit it. And in this case, the judge didn't permit it because the evidence didn't permit it. And when all you have is what I called in the brief, essentially dangling fragments that aren't connected in a way that is coherent, that is a proof of a specific fact, you have to go well beyond reasonable inferences, for instance, to say that Dr. Centeno testified that there was a permanent restriction. He did not. He testified he would rather not see him at Heights. That's all he said. There's one other point in the record that I think I'd like to take up, even though, frankly, it's disadvantageous to me because it focuses on the same question. Part of what Judge Moorhead said, and it was referenced in the reply brief, I believe, was that the plaintiff can't work in a raising gang. He appears to have made that leap, and I disagree. I think there is no support in the record for that conclusion on the judge's part. He appears to have concluded from what Dr. Centeno said 600 pages earlier. He doesn't give us the basis. Judge Moorhead doesn't speak to the reason for his conclusion, but he does say, I don't think he can work on a raising gang, and the evidence proves that. Well, no, it doesn't. And speaking to an earlier point that one of your honors brought up, he was making the same wage after the accident that he was before. He was not getting a reduced wage because his employer wanted him back and wanted to put him through a rehabilitative process. It's very common in the workers' comp realm, and that was what was going on. He quit that job, and that's why he didn't go back to work and took a lower wage. I see my time is up, unless you have other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel for their briefs and argument. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.